This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
To the third of the series of shiurim on the concept of sheker, of telling lies. Basically, we established in the first shiur the first principle, which was the tendency of a human being to be blind to any facts which don't fit in with his theme if he happens to approach the facts with a pre-chosen theme. And consequently, we talked about the general dangers of an individual taking decisions for himself when he's subjectively involved, the danger being that he's already decided on his theme before he looks at the facts, and he's going to miss facts while he's busy trying to weigh them up. In the second shiur, we took that a step further, and we talked about a person lying to himself about himself, where an individual makes a theme about himself. He decides what he is, not on the basis of what he does, but on the basis of what he would like to be, or what he would like to pretend to be, or whatever it is. So he decides on his theme. This is the image he would like to put out. And then he bends all the facts to try and convince himself that he is in fact what he hopes to be or what he tries to be. And even if they're not negative things, even if one aims to be a tzaddik, if the theme is I'm a tzaddik and the facts then are made to fit the theme, that's when tocho is not kabaro. That's when the inside and the outside are different. And one has to be careful not to enslave oneself, we said, to predetermined formulae of behavior which deprive one of the flexibility to be able to respond naturally to the situations in which one finds oneself. Now, Robert asked a question after those two shiurim, which is an accurate question. And I must say, when Robert asks a question after these shiurim, I listen carefully and I work very hard to answer them, because Robert spends as much time revising the shiur as I spend preparing the shiur, and he's one of the very few people that I'm satisfied understands the shiur. One of the very few. The question is, there's a contradiction. The first shiur we said, so you've got to be careful to have outside criteria, because if you're going to make your own decisions, you're subjectively involved. The second shiur we said, don't make yourself inflexible by using outside criteria. Feel a little bit, get the response, be flexible. And I'm going to answer that question, but before us answering that question, I'm going to introduce you to the third liar. We've met two of the liars so far. I'm going to introduce you to the third liar and ask a much more shattering question than that one, and after that we'll be able to answer it. The question is as follows. We've talked now about the dangers of having a theme before one looks at the facts. What happens if one's theme is not, as in the first shiur, a theme about a certain event, one isolated event that one's talking about, not that, and not in the second shiur, a theme about an individual, myself? What happens if the theme is much bigger than all that? What happens if the theme is a philosophy, a whole philosophy, a whole Weltanschauung, a way of looking at the world a person has, and that's his starting point, that's his theme? What then? Is that person faced with the same dangers of anybody else who sets out with a theme? Or is that somehow different? I don't know on the surface why it should be different, but I just hoped to find that it was different, because if we say it's not different, that creates very frightening ramifications. That means that if one approaches the world with a preconceived philosophy,
with a preconceived ideology, you already have no chance of seeing the world as it really is. And this creates tremendous problems. There are two chazal in this connection.
The first one is in Sanhedrin Daf Sadi Beis Amud Aleph, 92a, where the Gemara says the following. Omar Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Elazar said, Kol ha-machalif b'diburoi, anybody who tells a lie, and machalif b'diburoi is a subtle lie, it's not even a big lie, it's just a very subtle lie. Kol ha-machalif b'diburoi, ki'ilu oyved avodah zarah. It's as if he's serving idol worship. The Gemara equates the telling of a lie with idol worship. Now, we're not talking about equating the severity of the issur. That's a different discussion as well. Idol worship and telling lies are not the same kind of issurim as far as their severity is concerned. But what the Gemara is telling us is that there is inherent in telling a lie one of the same qualities that there is inherent in idol worship. What is that? There's an amazing Maharal Miprag. The Maharal says, the main issur of an idol worshipper is sheker. It's untrue. That's the main thing that's wrong with idol worship. And he proves it from this Gemara. And the Gemara says that anybody who tells a lie is as if he's serving idol worship. Says the Maharal, that indicates that the essence of idol worship is the dishonesty of it. And he says in clear words, the ikar hachote achet shechote ha'oved avodah zarah, the main sin which the oved avodah zarah sins, the main aspect of the avera, ikar achet, the main part of the avera. It's a tremendous chiddush, nobody else says it. Hu asheker. That's the dishonesty of the avodah zarah. The Maharal says this in the Be'er HaGoyla, in the beginning of the fourth Be'er. And here we see the basis of the answer to the question which I put before you. Yes, a false philosophy, that's Avodah Zarah. Or not even a false philosophy, we're not even onto that yet. A predetermined philosophy, which is not correct, also falls under Sheker. And it follows exactly the same paths which we laid out for the liar 2 weeks ago and a week ago. He has the same problems, he encounters the same limitations and difficulties, and that is the main problem with Avodah Zarah. To approach the world with a preconceived and wrong Weltanschauung, that's what's wrong with Avodah Zarah, says the Maharal. It's unbelievable. And I've quoted this Maharal to a number of Rabbonim who are shocked, and until I show them the Maharal inside, they don't believe that the Maharal says it. It's just the most amazing thing, that the main issur of Avodah Zarah is Sheker. But it's really not so amazing, because he's got something else to rely on. On the very posuk on which these three shiurim have been based, Midvar Sheker Tirchok, we were told in Mishpotim 2 weeks ago, distance yourself from lies. There's a mechilta which says in the name of Rabbi Noson, Midvar Sheker Tirchak, distance yourself from telling lies. Zu Azhoro Lifroish Min HaMinus, this is an instruction to keep away from apikursus. We're going to define what apikursus is still, but apikursus is wrong ideas, basically. Mistaken philosophies. Gentlemen, I want to start the shiurim on time, and I would like you all please to make an effort, gentlemen and ladies, please to make an effort to be here. Shabbos starts going out earlier and earlier now every week, so we're starting the shiur earlier and earlier every week. Next week we'll be starting the shiur at about 10 to 8. It's very, very bad to come in after the shiur has started, because I mentioned that there are very few people that understand the shiur. Coming in after the beginning, the chances of understanding are virtually impossible. And there's, according to the din, if you have to go out somewhere after the davening, leave straight after the Shmona Esra. One isn't allowed to extend one's davening or even stay on in the davening at the expense of being late at a shiur. Leave straight after Kaddish Tiskabel at the latest, you go, so that you're back at the beginning of the shiur. So
says the Mechilta that the very prohibition of midvar sheker tirchak, of keeping away from dishonesty, is also a philosophic prohibition. Careful of your philosophy. Your philosophy has to be accurate, it has to be true. And if you're an apikoros, in addition of all the other things that you're over, the isur of sheker, of being dishonest, is also one of the prime averos, one of the prime isurim, prohibitions, that the apikoros, the man whose views are incorrect, is over. And now I'm going to pose the shattering question. We didn't define sheker as being the preconception of a false theme. We defined it as the preconception of any theme. Because the moment you've preconceived, you're going to miss the facts. We weren't criticizing the sheker in terms of the nature of the theme. The theme might be very kosher. But if you have a theme, you're not going to see everything. A book of fiction might be conveying a very honest and very important theme, and a very moral one. But still there's an aspect of sheker in having to submit and subject the facts to the theme. Now comes the question. What happens if you approach the world with a preconceived idea of monotheism? Torah? God? What then? Will that also fall into the category of sheker? Not that the theme is dishonest. Not that the theme is a lie. But you're limiting yourself. You're not going to notice. You're going to be limited in your understanding of facts. I'll explain it still further. If you'll say that that's not considered sheker, that to approach the world with a preconceived idea of monotheism and God, then where do you draw the lines? Why can't a Hitler come along and say, I have a theme. It's a religious theme. It's not a political theme. I'm not doing this for my own good or for money. Why must they say that they are the Jews and the chosen people and the supreme race and we are Amalek? I claim that we are the chosen race and they are the Amaleks. Let's wipe them out. The same as they would wipe us out if they knew that we were Amalek. We do that kind of thing. We go wiping whole nations out on the instructions of the Ribbono Shel Olam. So why shouldn't a Hitler claim that's his theme? What right do we have to claim with any greater authority as far as the world is concerned? That we can wipe out Amalek, that's our theme. It's not based on any facts, because the moment we come across Amalek, we wipe them out straight away. So it's not that we're responding to something that they're doing to us right now. It's not self-defense. We wipe them out. And yet if Hitler wants to reverse the tables and say, I say that we're the supreme race, they are the Amalekites, they are the ones who have to be wiped out for the good of humanity. That's his theme. If we're going to allow people to approach the world with themes, who's going to know and be able to decide whether they are honest themes or not? And secondly, even if they're honest themes, aren't we limiting and restricting ourselves and putting ourselves in a position of sheker even though the themes are honest? The sheker being that we are simply limiting our view of the world. That's the main question which we have to deal with tonight. And the answer will shock you more than the question. The answer is yes. To approach the world with a preconceived idea of monotheism is also unacceptable. And that's the whole concept of Avraham Avinu. Let me read to you the Medrash at the end of Noach that relates very briefly and not in its full detail the story of Avraham Avinu. Rabbi Chia Breder Rav Ado de Yafo, Rabbi Chia, the son of Rav Ado from Yafo, Omar said, Terach oived litzlomim umoicher hoya. Terach, the father of Avraham, was an idol worshipper, and he used to deal in idols as well. He used to sell idols. Chad zman nafik liyata. One day he had to go away. Hoshiv la Avraham moicher tachtov. So he put Avraham to sell them in his place. So at this stage, Avraham himself is still not convinced of monotheism, otherwise he would never have sat in the shop. So we've got to understand that our origins, not even going back as far as Terach is concerned, But even Avraham's early days, there wasn't yet monotheism in Avraham's own mind. Havo'ati bar inish boi de yazbin. A man came along and wanted to buy an idol. V'hava'oma le bar kama shninat. So Avraham, the shopkeeper, says to the man, how old are you? V'hava'oma le bar chamshin or shitin. And the man answered, I was 50 or 60, whatever it was. V'hava'oma le v'hile l'hau gavra. Said Avraham, the shopkeeper, oy vavoy for a 60-year-old who has to pray to a 1-year-old. Don't understand it. So we see Avraham beginning to question. Avraham hasn't reached conclusions yet, because if he'd reached his conclusions, he wouldn't be sitting there. But you see the process beginning of Avraham's rejection of Avodah Zorah. V'hoyo misbayesh, and the man was ashamed. V'hoy lechlo, and he went. That strengthens Avraham's feeling and understanding. Chadzman atat chada itata te'ino biyodo chada pinach tesoilis. In Tana de Be'eliyahu, there's a little piece added in which the Medrash here doesn't bring in, but you've got to add it in to make sense of the Medrash. These brothers of Avraham, Terach's other sons, saw that Avraham wasn't much of a businessman. He chased all his clients away. Whenever they came to buy, he said something to them and they went off without buying. So they said to their father, Terach, this is no business. Avraham's not a businessman. Let's make him a priest. Let him become a kohen. Let him become a priest for Avodah Zorah. And they actually put him in to be a priest for Avodah Zorah. He served in an idolatrous temple. Right, says the Tana de Be'eliyahu. And then the following story is when he was a kohen, when he was a priest. A lady came with a basket full of flour. Omra lei. Holach krav kodmehoi. So she said to him, here's a basket of flour, bring it as a sacrifice before the idols. That's why I say you've got to add in that little bit, and it's very telling. Because if he's a shopkeeper, why are people bringing him the solet to bring as a sacrifice? So we see that Avraham was actually working in their temples at that time. Kam nosiv buklasa biyadei. Avraham got up and took a stick, a club, the tivron lekulon psile. And this is the point at which he decided to reject Avodah Zorah completely, and he had found the Ribbono Shel Olam. At that point, he took the stick and he smashed all the idols. And he put the stick in the hand of the biggest idol. He left one idol, that was the biggest one, and he put the stick in the hand of the biggest idol, and that was it. Kivan de'ata avua, his father came back. Amale man avid lohan kedin. So his father said, who did this? Amale said, Avraham, man nichbo minach. I can't tell you lies, I've got to tell you the truth. Atat hada itata, a lady came, ta'inala hada pinach de soiles, and she brought a basket full of flour. Va'omrisli, and she said to me, holoch karev kadmeh, take this and bring it as a sacrifice before the idols. So I took the flour and I put it before the idols. All of a sudden, one idol said, I want to eat first. Another one said, I want to eat first. And there was a big fight before I could do anything. That big one got up there, who was among them. He took a club, the tavrinan, and he broke them all up. Terach said to him, what are you playing around with me? Do they understand these things? If only your ears would hear what your mouth is saying. At that point, Terach took his son Avraham and he handed it over helplessly to Nimrod. Nimrod was the king. Amalei, so Nimrod said to him, Niskoid lenura, bow down to the fire and I'll let you go. Amalei Avraham, v'niskoid lemaya, dematfin lenura. Why should I bow down to the fire? I'll bow down to the water. Water can extinguish fire. Water is much stronger than fire. Amalei Nimrod, niskoid lemaya. Nimrod said, okay, so bow down to the water. It's also alright. Amalei imkein, niskoid lainana, detayin maya. Then let me bow down to the clouds that hold the water and bring the water down. They're much more powerful than the water itself. Amalei nisgud l'anana. He said, okay, bow to the clouds. Amalei imkei nisgud l'rucha de mevader anana. He says, then I should rather bow down to the wind that brings the clouds together and controls the rain.
Amale niskud l'rucha.
He said, bow down to the wind.
Amale l'veniskud l'bar inish desavil l'rucha.
Eventually he said, look, let me bow down to a human being who utilizes wind.
Amale milinat at mishtoy. You're driving me crazy here with words. You're talking nonsense.
Ani eini mishtachave el ha'oir. I bow down to fire. That's the only one I bow down to. Hare ani mashlichecha b'soicha. Let me throw you into the fire. Ve'yovei eloyo sha'atom mishtachave eloyi v'yatzilecha yemen. And if you bow down to some special god, let him come and save you from the fire. To this point, Avram had never spoken to God, had any communication from God, and he didn't have another single Jew. Does he jump into the fire or doesn't he? And here we're talking about courage of convictions. But from what are those convictions born? From a detailed analysis of facts. That's all. He's approached the world without a closed mind. He's been open to consider idolatry. The whole lot. He's examined all the standard religions. He's gone through it all. He was an old man at this time, according to many views. He's gone through the whole business with an absolutely open mind. When you've gone through it with an absolutely open mind and then you come to your conclusions, then obviously you must have the courage of your convictions. Now you've got to be prepared to die for those conclusions because they must be accurate.
Havataman Haran.
Medrash tells us a little interesting aside. There was somebody watching this whole conversation and his name was Haran. Haran was Avram's own brother. Chaim Palig, he was there and he was a bit worried and couldn't make up his mind. Omar, so he said to himself, Manafshach, either way I'll be alright. Let's watch this little business, says Haran. Im nitzach Avram, if Avram wins and he comes out alive, ana Omar minda Avram ana, then I'll say I'm a Jew, I follow Avram. Vim nitzach Nimrod, and if Nimrod wins this little bet, ana Omar de Nimrod ana, I'll say I'm following Nimrod. Is there anything wrong with that? He's also examining the facts, except there's still one fact to go. Is Avram going to come out of the fire or not? But Nimrod's making a mistake already. We'll come to his mistake in a moment.
Kivan sheyorad Avram lekivsho ma'esh v'nitzel. So Avram was thrown into the fire and he was saved. Amrinan leid demanat.
So they all came up to Haran and they said, who are you? Who do you belong to here?
Amale min d'Avram ana.
So I'm a Jew, I follow Avram.
Natlu v'shlichu eloyer.
They threw him into the fire.
The nichmuru bnei meyov, and his insides burnt out. The yotzol meisav bnei terach oviv,
and he came out of the fire and he died in front of Terach his father. And that's why it says at the end of Noach, vayamos Haran al pnei terach oviv, that Haran died in the face of Terach his father. That was the story of Haran. Here we've got two different people who are both having to take a decision on a matter of values. Avram and Haran, they're two brothers. One is successful. One is unsuccessful. We'll come on to Haran in a moment, but the first thing we've got to see is that the first Jew, Avraham Avinu, approached the world with a clean slate. He examined everything that there was, he examined all the facts, and as I said to you, this Midrash is brought in very, very brief detail. There are other Midrashim, and there's the Tanna de Beilio, where it's brought much more lengthily, the whole philosophy he goes through, and the analysis he goes through, and the scientific analysis he goes through, until he finally comes to the conclusion that there must be somebody leading the world, there must be somebody on top of it. At that point, the Ribbono Shel Olam revealed himself to him. Only when he came to the conclusion that there's one power leading and guiding the whole world. But we see he did it with an open mind. Why didn't he just say, I hear, I've been told, I read, something? No, that wasn't Avram. The first Jew approached the philosophy with a completely open mind. What about Haran? Before we look at Haran, let's look at Yitzchak. According to the one view, as I mentioned, Avram, and the more literal view, Avram was 70 when he discovered God. It took him 70 years of analysis. Or let's say the first few years of his life he wasn't busy with it, so it took him 65 years of analysis before he came to Yiddishkeit. 65 years. What is Yitzchak meant to do when he starts? Start again? Start analyzing from scratch? Surely not. That can't be right. Is Yitzchak meant to waste the first 70 years of his life also? Sure, there's merit in doing so. Surely Avraham's emunah must have been stronger and more powerful than anybody's ever since, because of having gone through that whole process. But even so, Avraham would never have recommended to his son to go through the same process. If a father builds up a business, builds up a fortune, he starts from nothing, he starts without a penny, and he works and he builds and he builds, and eventually he's got an empire. Is it right for him to say to his son, do it the way I did it? Start from scratch? Here's a penny, go out into the street and do what I did. I'm giving all my money to charity. No father would do such a thing. Yes, there are advantages in building up your own business from scratch. There are advantages in battling it all out yourself. But no father would do such a thing to a child. You carry on from where I left. We say, a bris kare de'av. A child is a branch of the father's tree. He's an extension of the father. It's the same life which continues. That's really what a son is. So with Avraham having gone through the pain and suffering of 65 years of analysis, surely Yitzchak can take over from where Avraham left off. That's how it must be. That was Haran's mistake. Avraham has done all the work already, Haran. You've watched the whole discussion, you've watched the debate. He's taken all the facts with an open mind and he's reached a conclusion based on all those facts. His intellect is superior to yours, Haran, and you know it. What are you still waiting for more signs for? To see if Avraham gets out of the kivsha. That's not a man with courage of conviction, that's a coward. If you satisfied, if you apply your intellect to Avraham's proofs, you've got to say to yourself, I go along with Avraham too, even if he doesn't come out of the Kivshan. I'll give my life for truth. What point is there for living a lie? What point is there in living a life which is based on things which are unreal? Living a life which is an illusion? Living a life which is going towards a goal that doesn't exist? What's the point of such a life? The whole value of a person who knows that he's onto the truth, that he's onto the MS, is if this isn't so, I die. I'm not prepared to live with something that I'm not sure of. And that Avraham was sure of, and when he went into that fire, he was ready to die. He didn't expect to be saved. He'd never seen a miracle before like that. He didn't expect to be saved. Haran wasn't prepared to take the chance. Haran's theme wasn't emeskat. Avraham's theme was the truth. That's all. I want to find the truth. That's the only theme. Haran's theme was save Haran's skin. That was his theme. He was prepared to bend the facts to save his skin. Not Avraham. Avraham went along with the facts all the way. So we see two interesting things. In reply to the first question, yes, one has to approach the world religiously with the same open-mindedness that we've been discussing everything else over the past 2 weeks. That's how Avraham approached it. However, not everybody has to start from scratch. If a doctor comes and he says, take these tablets, I don't have to say to him, 1 second, please show me the test results and the research done on these tablets. Please take me to a laboratory and I want to see how it works on rats before I take it. He says, don't worry, they did it already in America and the rats survived. Don't tell me what they did in America. I want to see the facts. Meanwhile, I'm sick. So what do? I trust my doctor. A son has to be able to trust the father. What's the basis of the trust of a son to his father? Without the father, I wouldn't be here. I'm nothing without the father. So I might as well trust him. I'm talking where a father is not only a father physically, but where a father is one spiritually as well, where he is transmitting the values of Torah. Then the son has to trust it. The one feeling, the one emotion with which one is permitted to enter a matter, the one mark on the clean slate, we've been talking about the open-mindedness and the clean slate. There's one blemish on that clean slate which cannot be erased and dare not be erased. And that's the blemish called trust. It's irrational. Why should I trust other people? One does. How do I, apart from trust in God, leaving out emunah at the moment, how do I go to sleep at night without putting 10 watchmen outside my house? How can I sleep? I trust that most people aren't robbers. It's not rational. Surely most people can know that I'm asleep and that they can get into my house as easily as anything, as they can get into any house. It's not rational that they shouldn't come into my house. The trust is not rational. when I drop a letter into the mailbox, and to go and believe that that letter is going to find its way to Timbuktu, and it's going to be delivered there. Why should anybody deliver it there? It's much easier to tear it up. Why should I trust that the postmen all along the line are going to take it out and handle it? They don't get anything out of it. I've bought the stamp already. I've paid for it. And in any event, the postman isn't paid a commission on every letter he delivers. So it's in his interest to dump the letter somewhere and to go home and take the day off. And if it was just one postman handling it, no. But when you think of how many links there are in the chain, how logical is it for me to rely that each man who handles this little letter along the line, the dozens of men that will handle it along the line, each one will be responsible to make sure that it goes to the right place, until the final one who actually drops it in the letterbox of the house to which it's addressed on the other side of the world. Why should I believe such a thing? It's irrational. But we do. We trust. Why should I believe when I phone up the telephone company and I report that my phone is broken, why should I believe they're going to come? What should they come for? What does it bother them? Surely they've got more important things to do. But you'll go mad, you'll go absolutely meshuggah if you don't trust. That's when people become neurotic. If you don't have a basic element of trust, the whole of society ceases to operate, and psychologically you can no longer operate. Sometimes one trusts too much and one burns one's fingers. One has to get it right. One has to develop an intuition for trust, because there's no logic to trust. Sometimes you logically work out that you can trust somebody and you can't. And sometimes you don't trust somebody and you should. Trust is an irrational feeling which starts, which there is in a human being, and on the basis of which he commits his life, never mind his money. Every day of the week, every day of the year, every moment, people are putting their lives in other people's hands with nothing but trust. Man goes into a hospital and allows himself to be operated on. And he signs that funny thing that they make you sign before you go. I mean, just signing that should make you terrified to even go in. He signs it. It's basically signing his life away. I have no claims on anybody who murders me, he's basically saying. Okay? Why shouldn't I believe that somebody's going to murder me on the way in the interest of medicine, maybe? You trust. You trust. You go in and you trust. And if you say, but okay, they go in when they're really desperate, but people don't. Even when people aren't desperate, they go in. They even go in for operations that they don't need at all, for all sorts of cosmetic operations and things. People do that. They trust. On what basis? It's a middle that people have. And the moment that middle will cease to exist, society will collapse. When people stop trusting each other, as they're beginning to do now already, then you get all the terrible afflictions of the society in which we live. And that's the second aspect of the shir tonight. The first aspect is, yes, one has to analyze with a clean mind, but you don't have to go over all the work which has already been done if you trust your authority. If I trust that my doctor has done sufficient research, or if I trust that my doctor wouldn't give me something which he's not satisfied someone else hasn't done sufficient research on, if I have that trust in the doctor, I'll take the tablets. That's it. If I don't, I won't. So the essence of the whole thing, the shortcut to research, is trust. That's what keeps a human being going. And that's where Haran made his mistake. Haran, trust Avraham, he's gone through the whole thing and he's prepared to give his life. He's your brother, you know him. Why aren't you prepared to give your life? He didn't trust Avraham. Nor had he gone through the whole thing himself. So number one, the essence of Yiddishkeit is to approach even Torah and philosophy with a clean slate. But number two, not every one of us has to waste 70 years doing it. And if Avraham with his intellect took 70 years, we with our intellects wouldn't manage it in a lifetime in any case. So we have to trust. Who are we trusting? We're trusting our father. That's it. I trust my father. I trust that he's not telling me lies. I trust that he's deliberately not misleading me. I trust that he's giving me over the principles of Torah as they were taught to him. Why shouldn't he? That's the trust. In the same way as I trust the postman and with a letter, so I trust a father with having put it over what he was taught. And as I mentioned in Shul over Shabbos, when it talks about bonim in relationship to Torah, about sons and fathers, it's not necessarily the biological relationship. A Rebbe with his Talmud is the same. exactly that same trust which I have in my father, I have in my other rabbi. Why should my Rosh Hashiva tell me lies? Why should he teach me how to learn Gemara a new way, different to the way he was taught? What should he do it for? If he learned satisfactorily, why should he? And he became who he became on the basis of his systems of learning. Why should he come and teach me something inferior or something distorted? So I trust him, absolutely. And so with the other rabbeim that I've had. And so it is, each individual trusts their Rebbe with having handed Torah over in an honest and in a manner of integrity. And so it goes back. My Rebbe trusted his Rebbe, and his Rebbe trusted his Rebbe, and his Rebbe trusted his Rebbe, who trusted ultimately Avraham Avinu's analysis. We're all depending on that analysis of Avraham Avinu, which was passed down generation by generation with meticulous accuracy. And as sons of Avraham Avinu, as grandsons of Avraham Avinu, as continuations, we feel as secure in our trust as if we had done the research ourselves. You don't think twice when you take a tablet that a doctor gives you. You don't think for a moment. Why not? You feel as secure as you would have if you'd done the research yourself. So much do you trust him. And it's correct. So much one has to trust him. And when one accepts the Torah, one's accepting it with the same conviction that Avraham Avinu had. Because it comes from his analysis that one does it. And that in fact is the meaning of the Gemara in Shabbos, Daf Lamed Aleph, which I've quoted to you a while back. Where the goy comes to Shammai and he says, how many Torahs have you got? And Shammai says, two. We've got the written one and the oral ones. Says the goy, I accept the written one, but convert me, but leave out the oral one. I don't accept that comes from the Ribbono Shel Olam. Shammai kicked him out. And he went to Hillel, and Hillel took the chance and converted him. He said, right, come for your first lesson tomorrow. We'll start Bereishis tomorrow. The goy came the next day and Hillel started with him. Aleph, this is what an Aleph looks like. This is what a Beis looks like. This is what a Gimel looks like. This is what a Dalet looks like. That was his lesson. Next day, the guy comes back for the second lesson. And Hillel reverses it. He shows him a Taf and he says, this is an Aleph. He shows him a Shin and he says, this is a Beis. He shows him a Reish and he says, this is a Gimel. He presses 1 minute. I'm sure yesterday you told me the other way around. So Hillel says, so in whose hands are you? Do you see how I can fool you? Do you see how I can lie to you? Which are you going to know? Which is right now? So you have to trust me in any case. If you trust me on the Torah Shebal Peh as well. Trust me on the oral law as well. Otherwise you've got nothing at all without the trust. And that's the important thing to know, that without the trust there's nothing at all. Absolutely nothing. That trust is even simplified further. Because at Har Sinai, at the mountain of Sinai, God revealed himself actually in front of 600,000 people, men, 2 million people probably, 600,000 men. As if almost to say, well look, you don't even have to rely on the analyses of Avraham. In front of a whole nation, I'll reveal myself publicly. But only once. Now comes the trust again. You have to trust your fathers for the future generations. But in front of 600,000 people, I'll reveal myself. And the Ribbono Shel Olam did. So now we don't really even have to go that far back. We simply have to trust our fathers as far as Har Sinai is concerned. And if we trust them on that, we've got the basis of Yiddishkeit already. What is the basis of Yiddishkeit? What emerges is that there are certain axioms. We're starting with trust. And that trust is a blemish on the clean slate which we've been discussing. A blemish which cannot and should not be removed. But it means that as a result of that trust, you're accepting certain facts a priori. The Rambam lists the facts. And there are 13 of them. And then, when you want to learn the 13 principles of the Rambam, then look in your Sidurim. Because that's, Lahavdil, that's to the Rambam what Lamb is to Shakespeare. It's not the real thing. If you want to look, you look at the end of Sanhedrin, where the Rambam lists each of the 13 principles of faith, and each one of them, even the shortest one, is longer than the whole 13 as they're printed in the Siddur. The first one is to believe
that there's a Ribbono Shel Olam. Number one. To believe in His oneness. Number two. To believe that He's spiritual, not material. Number three. To believe that He started everything off, there was nothing before Him. Number four. To believe that it is correct to serve Him and nobody subordinate to Him, nobody secondary to Him. If we're going to serve somebody, it's Him. It's five. To believe in prophecy, six. To believe in the prophecy of Moshe specifically, seven. Because if you don't believe in prophecy or in Moshe, the whole thing crumbles down again. Because Moshe was alone up there. We heard the first two commandments. We heard God say, I am God. And we heard Him say, you shall have no other gods. And then we heard rumbling and mumblings. But if we're not going to trust Moshe, there's no Yiddishkeit. Nothing. So we need to trust Moshe. That's seven. Number eight, we have to believe that every single word of the written Torah was dictated by God to Moshe meticulously, and that there's not one word there which is irrelevant or was made up by Moshe. Not one word. That's eight. Nine, that the Torah is complete as it stands and one may not add or detract from it. Ten, that God knows what people are doing. That God's alive and well and watching. It's 10. 11, that God responds. He responds positively to people who do good and negatively to people who do bad. 12, Mashiach. 13, Techiyas HaMesim, revival of the dead. Those are 13 principles which we have to trust on. That's where we start from. With those 13 principles we can move forward. How do we know those 13 principles? Avraham proved them. They're not axioms in the sense that they can't be proved. They were proved by Avraham. These are the 13 principles which Avraham proved. But we aren't permitted to waste time going over them again. These 13 we have to accept on trust. The same as we accept all the other things in our life on trust. We eat a loaf of bread and we don't suspect that there's poison in it. We assume that we can eat it. So we accept these 13 principles which are passed down to us by our Rabbeim, by our fathers, and we don't suspect that there's any kind of malicious intent in passing down false information. These are the 13 axioms, and I'm calling them axioms incorrectly. They're axioms in as much as we don't prove them, or don't have to prove them, but they're not axioms in as much as they have been proved, and we're now trusting. The interesting thing to note is that they're not quantitative axioms. Let me take it further. Says the Rambam at the end of the 13, V'chasher ya'amin ha'odom eile ha'yosoidos kulom. And when a man believes these 13 principles, all of them, and belief doesn't mean just saying, I believe. Belief is a deep, deep, deep emotion. It's trust. It's the ability to rely on it totally. And his belief in it is clear. At that point, who nichnas bichlal Yisrael, he becomes a Jew. It's incredible. Who is a Jew? Says the Rambam, a man who believes in the 13 principles of faith. That, legally, halachically, a Jew is a person from a Jewish mother, or halachically, correctly converted. But religiously, a Jew is a person who accepts the 13 principles. Mitzvah le'ahavoy, and it's a mitzvah to love such a Jew. Does it say anywhere here that the Jew must or mustn't be a chosid, or that he must or mustn't belong to this party or that, or that he must or mustn't be a Zionist? It doesn't even say he must keep Shabbos. It doesn't even say he must keep kashrus. It says nothing about what he's meant to keep. If he accepts these 13 principles, if he believes in these 13 principles, mitzvah le'ahavoy, it becomes a mitzvah to love him, ularachem olov, and to be merciful to him, velinhoig imoy b'chol ma'ashitzivo Hashem yisborach ish lechaveroy, and to relate to him according to all of the instructions that God has given us, ben odom lechaveroy min ha'ahavo, regarding love, v'ha'achvo, and brotherhood, v'afilu oso ma'sheyochol min ha'averos, and even if he did every possible avero,
Machmas HaTaiva, because he felt driven to. Vaizgabrus HaTeva HaGarua, just because his nature was so. Hunenash Gefich HaTov. He gets punished for what he's done, but that's not our business. That's God's business. Aval yesh lo chelek lo'olam haba. He has a part in the world to come, and he fulfills the requirements of a Yisroel, and one has to love him with all one's heart as one loves any other Jew. There's no requirement that he has to practice Yiddishkeit. There's no requirement that he has to be a Shomer Shabbos or eat kosher or be anything, as long as he accepts the 13 principles. You know, people go around with theories about how you've got to relate to different people and who you've got to relate to in what way. It's all written down. We've got it all. It's not necessary. Anybody who accepts with trust, not trust in God, because we don't know God yet when we start off. Trust in one's authority, trust in the source of one's knowledge, one's father or one's Rebbe. And one's prepared to accept, going back to Avraham Avinu, that these 13 principles have been proved and exist and they're true. Such a man is part of the Jewish people and he has to be loved and related to with full honor, dignity, respect, love, dedication, everything you want, as it lays down in the Torah. And a man, even if he keeps the mitzvahs but doesn't trust in all these matters, such a man is not a full-fledged Jew in the sense of the understanding of Yisroel as the Rambam is using it here. So we see again that number one, the one blemish on our clean slate is not a formula. It's an emotion. It's a quality. It's a feeling. The feeling is trust. And number two, the axioms which result from that trust are also trust. What are these 13 principles? To believe in God, to believe that He's one, to believe that He's spiritual, not material, to believe in prophecy, to believe in Moshe Rabbeinu, in Mashiach, in Tchias HaMesim. It's simply trusting that God really exists. That's all it is. That's the only formula. It's not a formula. That's the only spot on the otherwise clean slates of our minds as we take a step out into the world and we decide how to relate to the world. That's all we go with this knowledge, this trust in the Ribbono Shel Olam and the truth of the Torah. That's it. So we've answered tonight's questions. We've still got to answer Robert's question. Tonight's questions we've answered, yes, the principle which we laid down in the previous two shiurim, that by preconceiving a theme before observing the facts, one is involved in dishonesty, in untruth, that applies even to a philosophy. To have a philosophy before you go out and look at the facts, that's also no good. Except that we have our philosophy to a degree from Avraham Avinu. He's already done all the work. But what is that philosophy we take from Avraham Avinu? Only these 13 principles, that's all. The rest we've got to do ourselves. And the facts we now look for are in the Torah and in the world around us. Now to answer Robert's question. What are we meant to do? To rely on ourselves? We're likely to have a theme before we start analyzing. To accept the Torah as an objective standard? We've got a theme before we start analyzing. Okay, so the theme is genuine. So we believe, because of these 13 principles, we believe that the theme is a true theme. It's Torah. But in any case, we've said that even a true theme limits you. Even a true theme will cause you to look at the world with blinkers on. You won't notice everything that you should notice. You won't respond to everything that you should respond to. So what are you meant to do? Says the Rambam before the 13 principles of faith. I'm just going to read you a couple of lines from it because it's very fascinating. Kemoshu Amarnu, he brings a posuk from Tehillim, chapter 32. The pasuk says the following: Askilcha v'oyrecha b'derech zu tzelech. I will make you wise and show you the way that you should go. Iyatzo alecha eini. I will give my eye to you, I'll give you the benefit of my experience in the advice I'm about to give you. This is David HaMelech speaking, so this is quite some authority. What's the advice? Al tiyu kesus keferet. Don't be like a horse or like a mule. Ein hovin, who is incapable of understanding. B'mesek voresen edyo livlon. By bridle and bit, his mouth is held back. Bal keroy velecho, in order that he shouldn't come near you. What does that pasuk mean? The Rambam explains. It's not very often that we have the benefit of a Rambam giving pshat on a pasuk in Tanakh, and here he does it.
K'moy shehamoneya es habehemus mina hishtalchus.
In the same way, says the Rambam, as when you have to hold an animal back from running wild, hu dovar mibachutz. It's an external force which is holding him back. K'moy hameseg v'haresed. Like the bit and the bridle. And he doesn't understand, he's incapable of holding himself back. So you have to have the bit and the bridle in his mouth to hold him back. It's something from outside. V'ein roi shiyye odom kein. And it's not correct for a man to be in such a position. Aval yiyeh hamoinoi me'itoi u'me'atzmoi. The thing that keeps a man on the straight and narrow must come from inside him, not by the imposition of an external discipline. It's got to grow from in him. Ratzoni loyma, that means to say, suro ha'enoishis k'shitiyeh shlemo. When a human being is healthy and complete, he will instinctively keep away from those things which interfere with his perfection. Those are called the bad midos, which earlier the Rambam calls the averos, isurim, prohibitions. When a man is healthy, he will naturally keep away from the averos of the Torah. It comes from inside him. He builds up an inner aversion to the averos. And he himself from inside will push and motivate himself to those things which bring him to perfection. And those are the mitzvahs. This is what has been clarified to me by the words of Chazal, says the Rambam, in this very important matter. What has the Rambam said here? Exactly what we said on the first and second nights. Don't let Torah be an outside body of discipline which is imposed upon you. Because then you're starting with a theme. And you'll never grow with that perfection. It will never become natural. It will never become instinctive. But we're back to Robert's question. So what do you do? Do you just approach everything instinctively? You've got other themes before you start. Do you take the Torah and halacha as your theme? You're limited again. And the answer has already been stated. In the same way as in terms of philosophy, you have to go scratching around from the beginning. You've got to develop your philosophy from scratch with an open mind. But not everybody has to go and do the same thing himself. There's a question of trust. That's the human element which links the past with the present. The Gemara in Shabbos that I brought to you about Hillel and the non-Jew is very important. Because what Hillel is telling the non-Jew is, you don't have access to Torah Shebaal Peh without trusting a Rebbe. You have nothing. If you don't trust the Rebbe who's teaching you, don't even bother starting. You won't even learn Aleph Beis if you don't trust him. And if you're going to trust him, you'll learn the Torah Shebaal Peh as well. Because why should you choose to trust him in this and not to trust him in that? Torah Shebaal Peh, I've often talked about, was always meant to be Torah Shebaal Peh. It was always meant to be oral. And the reason it was meant to be oral is so that it wouldn't become a quantifiable formula. That it could be taught very sensitive to, or in teaching it, the teacher would be very sensitive to exactly how the student was taking it and what he was doing with it. He would watch at all times, correcting him the moment it went off course, putting it into practice and showing him how to put it into practice. On what basis? Where is he going to get it from? That's how my Rebbe used to do it. That's how my father used to do it. There's no way one can understand, even from the Torah Shebaal Peh as it is written, exactly how to be a Jew. It's not possible. One can see the facts, one can get the formulas, but you're dead the moment you take the formulas. That's the end of progress. It's the end of sensitivity. And it's the end of broad-mindedness. At that point, one becomes narrow-minded. And one becomes involved in things which are not MS. They're religious, and they're frum, and everything else, but they're not MS. Because you're not looking at things properly, you're looking at things with blinkers. And that's where the Torah Shebaal Peh has to be learnt from an individual. And I know I've said this many, many times, and I'll say it many, many times, but if I'm saying it still, it's because it's still necessary to say it. Torah Shebaal Peh dare not be picked up, either from a book, or from a source you don't trust implicitly. Don't do it, rather don't learn at all. To pick Torah Shebaal Peh up from a book is limiting and false. And to pick Torah Shebaal Peh up from somebody one doesn't trust is even more dangerous. Because you've got nothing. And that really is the answer. The Rebbe is the human link between the preconceived body of Torah and the explorations of the individual. It's he who allows the individual to explore and to discover without going too far strange, without wandering too far afield. Take the Rebbe away, and one of two things happens. Either the Talmud wanders too far afield and never comes back, or he gets himself into a straitjacket and he reads books and dinim and he just does what it says. Either way, he's dead, he's finished. Put the Rebbe in, and the Rebbe watches carefully. He watches the Talmud grope. He allows the Talmud to discover. He allows the Talmud to question, to analyze. But always keeping him within the framework. Always keeping him in the direction so that the Talmud won't have to waste the same 70 years which Avraham Avinu wasted before. Those things that he can pass over with trust, he passes over. Those things that the Talmud needs to discover for himself, he allows the Talmud to discover for himself. So that the Talmud allows himself to walk in the world. How can I put it? It's like not teaching a child to walk by putting him in these little round things that you walk. You make those things still, don't you? Still make them. Those terrible things that Robert and Bernard make. Those round things that constrict the child. The child holds onto it and waddles around the place. Okay, that's not the way we teach. And we don't teach by taking the child by hand either. We teach by letting the child stand up and fall down and stand up and fall down with a parent watching. Just watching. The child gets near the steps, we move the child away. The child's getting himself into a dangerous position, we realign him. We let him do it himself. That way the child develops the instinct. We let the child fall off the bed. We put an eiderdown on the floor before, so that the child develops the instinct of falling without damaging himself. We let children handle knives. We try and make sure that the knives they handle at first are not too sharp. They shouldn't be so blunt that the child can't cut himself. That would defeat the whole purpose of allowing the child to handle a knife. It should be such that the child can handle it, can hurt himself, but not damage himself. It shouldn't be so sharp that the child can do permanent damage. We let children play with matches, but not unlit matches. We let them play with matches that have just been lit and just been extinguished. They must still be very hot. The child must be able to burn his finger on the match. Feel what it's like to burn a finger on a match. And then ultimately we'll let the child light the match as well, but we'll be watching. That's the way the child develops an instinctive relationship with the world around him. And in Torah, it's just the same. If you're going to give a child a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch or whatever it is, a set of rules and principles and say, this is it, Shulchan Aruch, Rambam, Gemara is anything. The child has one of two things to do, either to reject it or to accept it. Either way, progress is over. Not only a child, a Talmud. a person studying, a student, there's only one solution, and that is to say, look, in order for MS to be achieved, you've got to go searching a little bit. But it's like Bedikas Chometz. We'll put the Chometz in the places. You'll find the answers. We'll organize it. You'll find, but you'll find it yourself. And the search mustn't be too easy, and the search mustn't be too hard. Each Talmid according to his own ability. So that he goes through the process of questioning as far as his mind is able to question. But he's able to find the answers. He's able to reach the answers himself. Try that without a Rebbe. Try that with a Rebbe that one can't trust. Implicitly. Can't be done. And there we have the answer, or the reconciliation of the first two shiurim. To go and do something on one's own, without an objective criteria, you'll have your theme before you start. You'll make a mess of it. To look up in the book and decide what to do, you'll have your theme. You'll make a mess of it before you start it. No. Wonder it, do it yourself. But just make sure someone's watching. Just make sure that that person knows he's meant to be watching also. Don't you assume that he's watching and he doesn't know that you're relying on him to be watching. Make sure that there's somebody watching. And that every now and then you keep sufficient contact with him to know that he's still watching. And that he'll pick you up if you fall down, and that he'll keep you away from the steps and the broken bottles. And then just have fun and do it yourself. And that's the method of learning Gemara. That's the method of exploring Halacha. And it's the method of exploring the practice of Yiddishkeit. So you'll make mistakes. So you'll do things on Shabbos which you shouldn't do. So you'll eat things which you shouldn't eat. It won't take long, and you'll know how to do it properly. But when you've done it properly, it will be you who's learned how to do it properly, instinctively and with understanding, and having done it correctly and gone through the right processes. A liar can lie when he's talking about little facts. A liar can lie about himself and to himself. And most dangerous of all, a liar can lie in the sense of his philosophy being incorrect. A liar, we said, is not only a person whose theme is wrong. Even a person whose theme is right is involved in lying, because he's going to miss the facts. And kol ha-machlif b'diburo, says the Gemara in Sanhedrin, a man who tells a lie is ki'ilu oved avodah zarah, it's the same kind of thing as idol worshipping. We took it a step further and we said to go in, even with a preconceived idea of Yiddishkeit, would cause the same problem, were it not for trust. And trust simply means we're relying on the questioning that has been done by others. In 13 areas, that's all. Those 13 areas we accept. The rest we have to battle with ourselves. We have to question the rest. Based on those 13 principles which we trust on, we have to question. We have to try. We have to explore. We have to do our best. But we have to do our best to internalize the Torah, says the Rambam just before the 13 principles. It mustn't be like a bridle and a bit. But the Torah is holding you back and the Torah is directing you. No. It's a matter of internalizing the principles of the Torah. And that can only be done the same way as a child internalizes the feeling of height when he falls off a bed, of heat when he touches a match, and so on, of sharpness when he cuts his finger on a knife. You've got to experiment. It's only through experimenting and groping that one will actually be able to internalize it. The majority of the experimenting is intellectually. Through mental questioning, analysis, absorption of learning, that's where most of the experimentation carries on. But also in the putting in of practice. When one's learned something, one tries it out. And if it's not quite right, one tries again. One modifies, one works, one improves. That's what Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are about. Every year, a little bit better, a little bit better. We're always experimenting, we're always trying. Once we've accepted the 13 principles, we're all accepted as honest people who are trying to do our best in Yiddishkeit. Whether we're managing or we're not, whether we're doing Averas or we're doing Mitzvahs, that's not what's important in the sense of our status within Yiddishkeit. We're accepted as beloved Jews the moment we're doing that, the moment we've accepted the 13 principles. And then we're all equal in a sense. And then we try our best, we just do the best we can to get it right. As long as there's somebody watching, we can allow ourselves to fumble a little bit, because that's the way we'll really internalize it. And that, although next week I plan to continue in a sense, probably with the whole concept of emunah, which is what we've come on to, trust, that really, gentlemen and ladies, is the end of the series on our three friends, shall I say our three acquaintances, the Shakronim, the liars.